The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Prepare your ears, humans. Happy, Sad, Confused begins now.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Cillian Murphy returns with Season 5 of Peaky Blinders. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. This is a special one. I say that a lot. Okay, I admit it. I say every episode special. But Cillian Murphy is the guest on today's Happy, Sad, Confused. And if you can detect the emotion in my otherwise emotionless body, I actually feel excitement today, guys, because Cillian Murphy's been on the list for a while. And he's a tough one, guys, because he, A, doesn't do that much press, and B, doesn't do it because he frankly doesn't, I don't blame him, he doesn't enjoy doing a lot of conversing about his craft and acting. He's not in it for the fame. He's not in it for the celebrity. He is so anti all of that stuff. And for that reason, I was worried about even, I was wondering when we'd actually get him in, to be frank. I've been working on this for a while. And B, I didn't know how it would go. Like, would he be miserable to be here? Am I forcing him against his will? Would he hate me? Yada, yada, all that stuff. Well, the good news is he came. He was happy. He was in a great mood. And we got along. He's a big old film nerd like me, like you guys. So we got on famously. We spent a lot of time afterwards just chit-chatting about other movies that we've seen recently. Like he couldn't have been better, and I'm so relieved that he turned out to be as charming and delightful as he was. See, just because you hate doing press doesn't mean you're a bad guy. It often actually means you're a good guy. So Cillian Murphy, if you don't know, has been starring the last few years on BBC's Peaky Blinders, which is one of the best shows on TV for my money. I discovered it way too late, like about a year ago. I caught up on all the episodes, and the new season is out there right now. It's on Netflix, the fifth season of the show. He plays Thomas Shelby, of course, kind of the leader of this crime family. He's now in politics in the fifth season. Such an amazing ensemble of actors that have repeated throughout, and now this season, we get Tom Hardy back in the mix for a little bit. We got Anya Taylor-Joy. We got our friend Sam Claflin on the series now. Well worth your time. If you haven't caught up with Peaky Blinders, I encourage you to do so right now. And of course, you know, in this conversation, we talk about a bunch of other things. Cillian has worked with some of the best filmmakers out there, whether it's Neil Jordan, Danny Boyle. We go in hard on 28 Days Later and Sunshine, which I love. I absolutely adore. And also just, you know, his association with Christopher Nolan, which I think a lot of audiences associate with Cillian's career. He, of course, was in all three of the Batman films, most notably Batman Begins as Jonathan Crane, a.k.a. Scarecrow. What you may not know is he was almost Batman, a.k.a. Bruce Wayne himself. He was up for that role. There's actually audition footage on YouTube you can find. A little snippet of him in the bat costume. It didn't work out. He wasn't right for that role, but what Christopher saw something really special in that audition and decided to pivot and make him Scarecrow. And ever since then, they've worked together on Inception and Dunkirk, and I'm sure they're going to continue working through the rest of their respective careers. So great things can come, even if you don't get the part you necessarily go in for. Other great things can happen out of it. So we're all the better for it, too. So very proud of this conversation, very happy that Cillian came by. I hope you guys enjoyed as much as I did. And other than that, what else to mention? I mentioned last week, you know, we've debuted the new Paramount Network series. If you haven't checked out On Location, please do so. I think you're going to enjoy it. If you love movies as much as I do, this is a show all about celebrating classic movies and the classic locations where they shot with amazing guests. The first episode is up with the great Lance Reddick talking about the John Wick movies. It's on Paramount Network's YouTube page. It's on Paramount Network's Facebook page. If you dig through my social media, Joshua Horowitz, I've been posting about it, so you can't miss it. and some really cool guests to come, including Kevin Smith and M. Night Shyamalan and Zooey Deschanel and a ton more. So yeah, good stuff happening all around. Hope you guys are enjoying all the cool fall movies that are starting to come out. If you've seen Joker, hope you dig it. If you didn't, that's okay too. Let's agree to disagree. That's all I'm going to say now. Let's go to the main event, shall we? Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to Happy, Sad, Confused. Spread the good word of my little podcast and enjoy this chat with Mr. Killian Murphy. Thank you for coming by today, man.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Big admirer of your work. You've been on the list for a while to talk to. I know this isn't like the favorite thing to do for you, so I'll try to make this as painless as possible. I feel like I've been circling you, whether consciously or unconsciously. I've had like everyone, Danny Boyle, Chris Nolan, Brendan Gleeson. It's like, this is your life, Killian Murphy, around you, building up to you. Peaky Blinders. Might as well start there.
Sure.
Because that's what the name of the game is right now. This is a great, great show.
Oh, thank you.
I've been a fan the last couple. I was a late bloomer. I think maybe a lot of Americans were. They took them a little time to catch up to what was cooking with BBC. You've done, what, 30, I'm trying to think, season five now, probably 30 hours of this?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So, you know, as somebody that probably likes to mix it up and keep it interesting, that's the nature of the job. Are you surprised that this series, this role, is still as richly rewarding for you five seasons in?
I'm delighted and surprised and, humbled, really. From the get-go, from reading it, I knew it was kind of something special. The writing was so strong and so confident and original.
Yeah.
This is 7 years ago we started it, so it's quite a while. I was aware that something was kind of happening in television, you know, because we'd all watched those kind of seminal American
like
shows.
The Breaking Bads.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, and I think the BBC were consciously trying to compete, if possible, with those kind of shows. And Steve just happened to step into that moment with these scripts, and I happened to be looking for television at that time, and it was all this lovely kind of confluence of sort of coincidence and serendipity, and it just happened, you know.
You mentioned Stephen. This is Stephen Knight, of course, who's your close collaborator on this one, the brains behind this wonderful crazy ensemble and saga now. The way it's developed is fascinating. I mean, I almost say to like people that don't know anything about it, it's like, imagine like a crime drama, like The Godfather stretched over 30 hours. Like it's got that kind of like intricacy within a family played against such a rich tapestry, a rich time period, a rich location. And to see sort of the way these interpersonal relationships kind of intermingle with history.
Yes.
Is quite fascinating. What was Stephen's like? Did Stephen pitch you, or was it on the page what he gave you?
I had met him before for another movie a couple of years before that, and we'd gotten on really well, and it didn't work out for whatever reason.
Right.
And so I was an admirer of him, and I knew that when we sat down together, we kind of had we got on very well.
Yeah.
And we and so then when it came around again, I was aware that he was a proper talent at that stage. I think he talked to me about it, and he talked to me about, you know, what it was influenced by, which was really, you know, the fact that in Britain, television generally had been about the upper classes, the aristocracy, the sort of upstairs, downstairs
right.
type of story. And that there had never really been a piece of television that sort of mythologized the working class in Britain, which you guys here in America do so brilliantly, you know, mythologizing cowboys and, you know, Italian Americans, which are all effectively
right.
immigrants, essentially. And we, I speak as an Irishman, but in Britain that hadn't really happened. So Steve was about, I suppose, addressing that, and also setting a story not in London, but in Birmingham, which is the second city, but for a long time was not a very fashionable city. And but he wrote about where he's from, which is Birmingham, and this story was handed down to him by his uncles and his mother. So he lived with it for a long time before he put pen to paper. Yeah. So it was very rich. Now, inevitably, it is a gangster piece, and it is of that genre. But I think it has a different spin on it because it's British, and because it's between the wars. You see these men, and they're sort of stumbling through life, suffering the aftermath of being, ejected from the most mechanized, most horrific bloodshed ever known to man to that point, which was the First World War, and they're trying to having to adjust to society and having to find a place for themselves, and each of them, the characters in our show, sort of dealing with that in a different way. So that was a very exciting setup. So from the beginning, all the characters were broken.
Yeah. And that's a good place to start as an actor. You don't want a fixed guy. You want the guy that's trying to piece himself back together.
Exactly, yeah.
And So are you just still discovering new things about Thomas 5 seasons in?
Yes, for sure. And he writes it so elegantly. He reveals very, very slowly. It's like peeling back layers every season, and you get insights back into what Tommy was like pre the First World War.
Right.
And I think Steve's arc is to ultimately redeem him, because he is, in Steve's words, a good man who does bad things to a good end.
Right.
Which I really like, and he's a contradiction. As we all are, as human beings. So every series now, he's a politician, he's an MP. Yep. How do you reconcile that with being a gangster? How do you reconcile being a father with being a gangster? How do you reconcile being a husband? How do you deal with an ideology, a fascist ideology, something that you can't. Something that you can't use, machine guns against.
Yeah.
So all of that stuff, it's just very rich.
Rich territory for you. Yeah, you mentioned the rise of fascism, which is kind of like the backdrop of this season. Mm-hmm. You bring in someone I've gotten to know well over the years, Sam Claflin, a very talented actor.
Great actor.
And I've never seen him in a role like this, and that's sort of the fun of this one.
He smashes it in this.
Oh, he kills it in this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, stay through the last episode. It's amazing. Yeah. You end the season on a really great, powerful note. And it creeps up on you, too, that character. I've been struck from the start of the show. You anchored this show, but you're surrounded by this amazing ensemble of actors, some of which have been consistent throughout and some that come and go. Your buddy Tom Hardy. delicious to watch always.
Mm-hmm.
You guys have worked together a few times. Yeah,
we go back, me and Tom. I kind of knew him years ago. And we were both kind of getting going, and then we did a few Chris Nolan films together.
Right.
We were in Inception together, and then I think I was in one of the Dark, or one of the Batman films that he was in.
Yeah, he was in Rises, the third.
Sure. Yeah. And then every year in Peaky. So, we keep in touch, we get on great, and I love acting opposite him. He's such an inventive, unpredictable actor.
That's what you want.
Yeah, and it feels like they're sort of kind of brothers from another mother or something like that. Mm-hmm. They were both in the war together, and they have this amazing kind of antagonistic friendship, which I really enjoy. So yeah, and then people like Sam Neill.
Fantastic.
Adrian Brody. Helen McCrory, who I adore, these fantastic actors.
And then the season you bring in people like Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always keeps it interesting. So for someone like Tom, I'm just curious, from an actor perspective and somebody that's like a friend of his, like, I don't know about you, Al, I as just like a fan of the medium and of acting and just seeing performers I respond to, I like it when actors make big choices that go for it. you know, I think of him doing Bane, which he could have fallen flat on his face. And I was just like obsessed with what he did there. I don't know about you.
Loved it. Yeah.
Right.
Loved it.
I mean, what is your kind of philosophy on, like, is it, I mean, this maybe is the wrong phrase to use, but go big or go home. You don't always need to go big on a character if it doesn't necessitate that, but you do want to make strong choices.
For sure. And I think it comes from the environment that you're in, which is generally created by the director.
Right.
Now, for example, if you're on a Nolan picture, inevitably Chris has written it.
Yes.
And he's directing it. So, and he's, you know, one of the greatest filmmakers we have today.
Yeah.
So you're in a really safe place to create and to sort of explore and, you know, try stuff that might in another context seem outrageous. But, you know, when you have the confidence of a filmmaker who is going to walk you through it
and protect you on set and in the edit and know how to calibrate that.
Yeah, and I think those situations, that's what every actor hopes for, is that safety net, that place where you can experiment and go big, and it might not always work, but then you can change it, and you know, that's what we all hope for, I think.
Can you for something like Thomas, who is 180 from you, is as far from you seemingly as possible, mm-hmm. I would hope.
Believe me, I'm not that interesting.
Well, I'll be the judge of that. But, I mean, even in the physicality of him, the way he carries himself, I'm sure you're not a smoker, I don't think.
No.
You had to smoke a lot of fake cigarettes over the last 6 years.
Yeah. Like, I suppose when I read the scripts and I knew this guy had to be sort of... he had to be physically intimidating. He had to be intimidating in his presence. It was an exercise in kind of trying to find ways that me, who's not a very physically imposing person, could embody this character who was that sort of physically imposed. So, you know, drop the voice.
I was going to say, the voice and that's something that I've noticed in a bunch of your characters over the years. Like, that's always, that can really tell a lot about a character.
Well, it's a way of finding, you know, you can find a way into a character through various ways. And I spent a lot of time with Tommy trying to find ways. Like, he's a decorated soldier, veteran of the First World War, right? Yeah. So the guy is, you know, he's seen stuff that you and I couldn't even begin to conceive. So then the haircut, the voice, the walk... the costumes, you do everything you can to make you not look like just an actor who's walked in off the street. So it was a long process to get there, and it's kind of evolved over the course of the show.
It must boggle your mind that the haircut has become, I mean, I'm sure in every interview you talk about the haircut.
Well, it's nuts, isn't it? I mean,
it's become a thing. It's like you've started a trend that's lasted. It's like it's not since the Friends Rachel haircut.
It's beloved of like fashionistas and hipsters. And I, you know, the weird thing is I keep saying to them, you realize it's to prevent against lice. Like, just be
nothing
aware.
More trendy than going against lice.
Yeah, in hair infestation. But, but it's a very graphic silhouette.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Of course, yeah.
With that haircut, the cap and the costume, it became instantly sort of recognizable as a peaky thing. Again, it was a total fluke, but we just chanced upon something. All of this is kind of alchemy.
Of course. If it's not in a boardroom, you're like, wait, how are we going to get the zeitgeist to be interested in
No
us?
One knows, and no one knows.
Yeah.
And again, if you ever try and shoot for a specific demographic, you ever try and shoot for, to be fashionable or relevant, you're dead.
Yeah.
None of these things happen by design. It was just total, it was just luck.
You also have, over the years, have had, you know, maybe the coolest soundtrack of any show. If I were you, I was going to say I would have Red Right Hand as my ringtone. Maybe I wouldn't. Maybe that's the worst actually possible idea. And some musicians have fallen in love with the show, too. Bowie was a fan, wasn't he?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Bowie was a fan,
did he reach out to you?
Yeah, I got to meet him, and... Yeah, it was quite humbling, and sort of unbelievable that he was a fan and wanted to have his music in the show. And Leonard Cohen and, you know, Radiohead and Nick Cave, obviously. It all kind of started with Nick Cave.
Sure.
He sort of set the bar and the tone and the atmosphere of what the music would be. But musicians really seemed to love the show. And this year, Anna Calvi did the score, and she's an incredible artist. And yeah, and I'm a music obsessive, so
this must be icing on the cake for someone like you. I know you would have been just as happy making music your life.
Well, yes, except it wouldn't be very good. But to have musicians that I've idolized, you know, offer their music to the show has been so just kind of a pinch yourself moment, you know.
So going back, if you'll indulge me for at least a little bit, so music was a love as much as acting, or even before acting, growing up. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah, I didn't start acting until I was 19, so it was all music, yeah.
So what did your parents, you come from a long line of teachers, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of teachers in the family.
Yeah.
What did they make of the artist's son who was fascinated by music and then acting? And
well, here's the thing. Because they were all teachers, majority of them were teachers, it's not to say that they didn't have a, you know, big interest in the arts. It was just at that time in Ireland, there was very, very few people made actually a living from being an actor.
Sure.
Or a writer or a musician. And if they did, they had to leave. And so there was always books in our house, always music in our house, but it just...
It wasn't a realistic, yeah.
Yeah, a possibility. And I didn't even. I just sort of fell into it by accident, you know. But they're very proud and very happy, you know. And it's worked out fine.
I'd say so. Yeah. What were the films and TV that really drew you in as a boy? Do you remember what really made an impact? Any memorable theater going experiences for you?
Yeah, there's a few things. I mean, Twin Peaks was a huge thing. Watching that as a kid, I remember watching that and hiding behind the sofa just watching it.
I think we're like almost exactly the same age, right. So we would have been, I think, 12 or 13 there was around when, yeah.
And it still haunts me to this day. You know, some of those
that
images.
Angelo Baldamenti score.
What a score! The atmosphere. See, one of the hardest things to do, I think, in film and television is atmosphere.
Yeah.
Where you feel like you're in it. You feel like it gets into the fiber of your being. You know, you can smell it almost.
Yeah.
That's so hard to get. And Lynch just does that, you know.
And I always think of it as, even though I could rewatch the opening credits to that show over and over. I mean, you see the waterfall and the music and you're just there.
Yeah.
You're there.
And, you know, again, it's another one of those how, why, but it just works. You know?
You've never worked with Lynch, have you?
No. I would love to.
Pretty amazing. Yeah, I don't want to unnerve you, but I've watched a bunch of the missing films that I hadn't seen in your filmography the last few days. So I watched Disco Pigs, and I'm ashamed to say I had never seen Breakfast on Pluto, even though I'm a huge Neil Jordan fan. But Disco Pigs was the big one that really did transition for you. Like, I mean, you had done this on the stage for a while.
Yeah.
And then you guys made a film of it.
Yeah.
So what you kind of lived that character for a while.
Yeah, I did it when I was like 19. It was my first ever professional role on stage. And then I went off and did other bits and bobs.
Yeah.
And I did a couple of other films. But that was about 4 years later, we made the film of the play. And I suppose it was the first film that people saw, really.
Yeah. Did it immediately open doors? Do you feel like a world was opening up to you in terms of opportunity?
Well, Danny Boyle saw it when he was casting 28 Days Later. So that certainly, it put me in the room with him, and then I had to audition for 28 Days Later.
I would assume as you must have been a fan of Danny's by the time you got in that room.
Yeah, I mean, Shallow Grave, Trainspotting were seminal sort of formative movies for me. I remember watching them in the cinema.
Yeah.
I was like, I recognized that fact that he was, you know, world-class director. And I worked my ass off on those auditions.
I'm sure. He's been in here, and I've talked to him a number of times. He's just has such a spirit to him. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just like, he's like someone like Tarantino. You could talk to him about film for hours, and he seemingly has like boundless enthusiasm.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that fair to say on the set of his films?
Yeah, like the joy of filmmaking just runs through him. And I remember the thing that always stands out for me about Danny is that he you know, some directors will have a perch behind Video Village and they'll sit there. Danny never sits down. Never. Like, so you have a 16-hour day, whatever. He never sits down. And that enthusiasm or that joy just percolates down to all of the crew, and they'd follow him to the end of the world, you know, because he has such passion for it, and he knows every single person's name. You know,
these are the small things that matter.
Absolutely, and that's what makes you a sort of a leader. You know what I mean? In that, because ultimately the director is the leader.
Is it disheartening sometimes when you look around and I mean, all directors do it different ways. Some live in Video Village. Some are right by the camera. Mm. Would you rather have them kind of next to that camera?
Well, I can only speak from my experience, and I've been very lucky. But people like Danny Boyle, people like Nolan, they are in and involved with every single detail of every department.
Yeah.
And effectively, if they could, they would be the head of each department. But, you know, it's a collaborative business. But, yeah, no, that, like Chris Nolan, when he shoots those movies, it's Chris and the cameraman and Chris and a little monitor. That's it. And the boom op. Even, you know, and they have these the sense of epic scale, but it feels like making a little indie movie, you know?
Yeah, that's what the best do. I mean, I also rewatched Sunshine, which for my money is one of the great underrated like classics of the
underrated.
I think so. I mean, in that like,
no, I agree with you.
Don't you think? Well, I mean, it's a gorgeous like marriage of like music and sound and image and just emotion. It's a powerful piece of work.
Space movies are tough, you know?
I know it took a lot out of him. He's talked about how, like, that one kind of broke him.
Yeah, it was tough for all of us. And I think sometimes with space movies as well, there's a few we could mention that when they were released, people were like, eh.
Oh, sure. And even 2001 at the time. Yeah.
Like Alien, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then people over time go, actually, and I think that's kind of happened with Sunshine. Didn't it came out also on the hottest day of the year?
Irony right there
in London, which didn't
great happen. Viral marketing by Danny Boyle and Fox's part.
Let's not go and see that film today. But it in fact Tarantino, it's one of his favorite space movies. So we were all very, well. I certainly was very heartened to hear that because I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, and going back to 28 Days, that was also notable in one of the first, if not the first, digital. Films. Did that make any difference to you at the time? Like, do you notice the apparatus that's being used? Or do you notice, wait, I'm doing takes that are going on for an hour as opposed to 5 minutes? Or?
Well, you see, they were domestic DV cameras. They were like on these little tiny cartridges. And they were these big cumbersome yokes. And it was Anthony Dodd Mantle who shot that film, who's an incredible DP. He would have been part of the Dogma movement, you know.
Sure.
And so we could have those cameras everywhere, and you could just get like anyone could operate them once they were Anthony set them up the correct way. But everyone was just carrying around these little cartridges of film going, and you know, you'd
feel so flimsy. And that's like, wait, that's so actually frightening as a
it
artist.
Is. But it wasn't quite DV or digital as we know it now. The quality is unbelievably grainy.
Right, you can imitate or achieve anything with digital now, virtually.
Yeah, this was
don't tell no one that, but
no,
a lot of people.
No, not for Chris, but like very low fidelity, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. But it gives it almost gives the thing that he wanted, I think, was the idea that it was like someone was just running behind them with a domestic camera filming them, you know. And it was, I think, influenced by that Dogma movement, which was around that time.
Yeah. So in the wake, I mean, that is, as much as Disco Pigs opens up a world, that opened up a whole variety of options for you. That must have been challenging, exciting, a lot to take in as a young actor. Did you feel like, I know what to do with this kind of, to use the horrible phrase of like juice in Hollywood, you know what I mean? Like, did you know how to like set priorities and know what kind of path you wanted to set out on at that point?
Well, no, is the short answer. but I guess I was very blessed to have worked with Danny that early in my career and to realize that, you know, I was kind of informed by the way he worked.
Yeah.
And the sort of movies that he talked to me about and the intensity at which he worked. And also Alex Garland, who wrote it, who was a friend of mine, you know, he influenced me a lot. And so I was very clear then, I think, about the sort of films that I wanted to do and the sort of films that I wanted to steer clear of.
Yes. I read some quote of yours. It's like, I'm not even going to try and like approximate it, but like the power of saying no. It's as important to know what to say no to.
Yeah. And I would have been, I suppose, quite shy and stuff, and not very good at doing the old work in the room, shall we say. And I always felt, and I still feel, that the work should do the talking, yeah. not the person. I went back and did more theatre after 28 Days Later. It didn't go skyrocket all of a sudden.
Yeah. It's kind of spoiled in a way by like working with these people, like relatively early on, like Danny, and then relatively soon thereafter meeting Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
Who are the ones that can like operate on the grandest scales, but make it still feel intimate and special and not like cookie cutter Hollywood crap. You meet Christopher on the audition for Batman Begins.
Yes.
You were a fan, I know. Yes. Memento, following Insomnia at that point.
Mm-hmm.
There's tape out there of you in the bat suit online if one wants to watch.
Yeah. So. And you could see why I didn't get the part.
You're a slight man. You could have filled out if you wanted to.
Well, you know, at that time, whatever. I knew that Christian Bale was auditioning, and I was like, well, that's obvious that he should play the
American
part.
Psycho guy? But, see, look at his chest.
But also, he's a phenomenal actor.
Amazing, yeah.
And, you know, it seemed to me obvious. But for me, I was just taking it like it was like a trip. It was like a, wow, I get to go on the Warner lot and like do a screen test with Chris Nolan. Boom, I can tell my kids about that.
Sure.
If nothing else. And then it turned into something else. So.
Does something like happen where anybody that gets in the bat suit, you feel like you have to like change your voice and do kind of the growl? Like it just, you have to, right? Or lower register?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't directed to do that. but it just felt like, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to be like, hi, I'm Batman. No, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't work.
No. For some reason, yeah, it just something drops when you put that cowl on.
It's tightness in the belt or something. Thankfully, it worked out for everybody. Because also, I will say, like, I don't know about you. I don't know if you think back. Like, if you became Batman, you might be miserable. Like, I don't know. Like, knowing what I know about you, like, I don't know if, like, that would have been the life you would want, in a way. Do you think about it in those terms?
I don't ever think about it like that, because it ended up working out great for me, because I ended up having a very fruitful working relationship with Chris, and I think Christian Bale just killed it as Bruce Wayne and Batman. So no, I never really think about it like that. I believe as well. You know, if you have some sort of authenticity about you,
mm-hmm.
that you get the roles you're meant to have.
Right.
Now, that sounds really cheesy. What I mean is that if you're relatively comfortable in the path you want to move along,
yes,
creatively, that stuff comes to you for a reason. You
know? Yeah, I mentioned I finally caught up on Breakfast on Pluto many years too late, but. What an exceptional performance, and I've always been a fan of Neil Jordan's.
He's so good, man.
So great. Yeah. I mean, yeah, and I'm sure as any great Irish actor that's on the list, you want to work with Neil Jordan.
Mm.
And just like a beautiful portrait of Kitten is such like a open-hearted, sweet character. Talk about voice. That must have been a big part of it, to like find that cadence. And
yeah. Yeah. I spent a lot of time preparing for that one. Months. Trying to get that right.
Yeah.
And again, it's like, you know, with Tommy, it's a series of sort of explorations and exercises and just tests to see what works best and what doesn't work. And eventually you kind of narrow it down.
Another one on the list that I'm sure you take pride in is When That Shakes the Barley, Ken Loach, who's a fascinating filmmaker. I mean, it's hard to make, you know, quote unquote, important film that doesn't feel like medicine. That film at the end of the day is really about brothers, and is just packs a wallop by the end.
Yeah. No, I mean, again, you know, I think he's one of the greatest filmmakers we have. Yeah. And if you look at his body of work, the performances he gets from actors, the messages that his films have within them, the integrity that he has as a filmmaker, I just feel very privileged to have worked with him. And he's also a human, like an astounding human being.
Yeah.
So, that was another kind of milestone for me. And, you know, it was to me, as an Irishman, to make a film about my country and actually my county where I grew up, and then for it to sort of resonate was really satisfying.
Yeah, and a film about obviously the IRA and how it splits apart families and what it did to your country. I mean, growing up, just that time period, you must have grown up when the IRA, like, what was your understanding of the IRA as a child? Like,
well, I mean, I grew up in the 80s, really, and it didn't, like, the South, it was really just on the news.
Yeah.
It never came home in any sort of tangible way, but, it was all over our curriculum in school. But the Civil War, which Ken deals with in the film, that had never really been treated on screen. And when it came out, like, generations of, like, grandmothers were going to see with their grandchildren and stuff. And I think it was a good thing. It was kind of a cathartic thing for the country.
Yeah. Jumping around a little bit, but, like, it occurred to me, I forgot to bring up what I thought was another exceptional actor you got to work with in Breakfast on Pluto was Liam Neeson, which in a role that, like, very unlike I've seen him do before, must have been a treat. Is he somebody that you kind of revered when you were coming of age as an actor?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a sort of, you know, Liam Neeson, Brendan Gleeson, and Stephen Ray.
Yeah.
Gabriel Byrne.
Yeah.
Those guys, you know, they lay the way for all of us, and we were all sort of in awe of them, and I still am. And I haven't got to work with Gabriel, but I've got to work with all the others. With Brendan, like, 5 or 6 times, and Stephen several times in film and on stage as well. Oh, so nice. They couldn't have been more encouraging and more supportive of me as I set out and my, whatever you call it. and they're just gentlemen, you know.
Is it weird to work with someone like, you're in Dunkirk and you see Barry Keoghan, and be like, oh wait, there's the next gen.
Yeah, and how good is he?
He's great. I just met him for the first time. What a spirit on him. He's got the stuff.
He really has. He's so good. You know, like, people like him and Jack Rayner. You know,
Jack was just here too. He's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're such strong actors. Yeah. So, yeah, there's, for a small country, I think we have a fair output.
Yeah. A few things I'll hit, and then I promise to release you out into the wild, sir. What did you make of the Inception script the first time you read it? Did you need Christopher to explain to you what the hell was going on, or did it read on the page?
No, I think it took a few reads.
It's dense, I'm sure.
Yeah, but you have to remember he lived with that story for 15 years or something before he'd got to make the film.
Yeah.
So he knew it, every single frame of that film. And so again, you felt in totally safe,
yeah,
total confidence, and I'm like, hang on, whose mind or what level are we? And he would just tell you, you know, work it all out for you.
And again, the beauty is, like, at the end of the day, I mean, it's a film with a lot of bells and whistles, and they're gorgeous to look at and experience. Mm. But, like, oh, wait, it's a story about a father and a son. It's Pete passed away in one of his sadly final performances. It's just kind of beautiful scenes with you guys at the end amidst all this bombastic excitement.
Yeah, I think that's what Chris does so brilliantly. He makes these incredibly sophisticated blockbuster movies, but they have a real emotion to them. I find them incredibly moving, his films, you know.
I wait for the Christopher Nolan James Bond movie one day, which I feel is inevitable.
Do you think it's going to happen?
Absolutely. He's been making it in some ways in different forms already, and he's unabashed in his love. It just needs to be the right timing, I think, don't you?
I mean, listen, I'll go to see it.
I won't go down the Bond route. I know every actor that I've talked to over the years, whenever you bring up James Bond, they like, oh, no, I can't say anything.
No comment.
It's fine. We have a weird indirect connection in that my brother wrote Tron Legacy.
Oh, really?
He did. Adam Horowitz.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and you, of course, you had a notable cameo in that one.
Well, yeah, because I adore the first movie, and who doesn't, you know? Yeah. And it's again, a movie I watched as a kid. Yeah. Like, it would come on the telly sometimes late at night.
What is
this movie? And I was just bugging my agent, going, is there anything in that that I can just be in it just for my kids? And everyone keeps saying, oh, they were setting it up for something. I don't know if they were. I just wanted to be in it, you know? That's all.
I got some inside info. They were setting up for something.
Were they?
I think you were going to come back.
I didn't know that.
I don't understand how a $400 million movie doesn't get a sequel. It was good. I liked it.
Let's start a petition.
You are on a notable sequel you can't say anything about. I think you just shot the new Quiet Place movie, mm-hmm. right? Fun to be. I mean, John Krasinski's obviously looking at this time. He could focus solely on the directing, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
How was that experience without, I know you can't say much about it, but did it feel?
Well, there's a good story about that. I brought my kids to see that movie in the cinema last year, and I thought it was one of the best films of the year, and I voted for it in all the awards. And I penned a letter to John Krasinski, an email, and I rarely do this, just to say, man, what an achievement. Because to me, again, it was ostensibly, you know, a sort of a genre film, but to me it felt, it was all about family.
Of course, yeah.
And I found it, like, Emily Blunt's performance and the family unit, I found it just so moving and also terrifying. So anyway, I penned this email, but then I didn't have the guts to send it to him. I just got embarrassed. And then he called me up and said, look, there's a part in the sequel. So.
That's how powerful John Krasinski is. He can read the emails that aren't even sent.
I know. He's just like his own server.
He's the master of Tron. He's the MCU.
Yeah.
Do you know what you're doing next? You mentioned stage is going to take a backseat for a while. That's a commitment.
I did a very intense play here in New York this year, and I just need a rest. So, and I just finished Quiet Place a couple of weeks ago. I'm just having a rest.
Yeah. Do you show your sons much film? Like when they came of age, when they started to be old enough to watch films, like, did you have the list of the ones you needed to expose to them?
Yeah. Mostly, you know, I'm not going to show them, you know, I don't know, like
Kurosawa. Okay. Exactly.
But I want to, you know, all the classic 80s movies, you know what I mean? Like Back to the Future, I mean, and all the Indiana Jones, all those movies, like big. The Goonies, just watching those movies and seeing the joy in their faces watching that. That has been a real thrill.
They all work, thankfully. They still
all work. All of those work. They didn't fail.
You didn't mention the ones that don't quite hold up. But those work still. No, good.
They always ask me, like, how long ago was it made? And it doesn't matter.
Don't make me feel older than I am.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking indulging in a little bit of the This Is Your Life, Killian Murphy. I appreciate it, man. I'm thrilled that you came by today to chat about Peaky Blinders. Thanks, man. Congratulations on the new season. Everybody should check it out. It's on Netflix. Peaky Blinders, if you're late to the party, it's never too late. Join the fun. It's an amazing piece of work. Killian, thanks again.
Lovely to chat, man.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it. That was great.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.